Recorded Books and RB Digital present A Time to Love and a Time to Die by Eric Maria Remarque. Narrated by MacLeod Andrews. Chapter 1. Death smelled different in Russia than in Africa. In Africa, under a heavy English fire, the corpses between the lines had often lain unburied for a long time, too. But the sun had worked fast. At night, the smell had come over with the wind, sweet, stifling, and heavy. Gas had filled the dead, and they had risen like ghosts in the light of the alien stars, as though they were fighting one last battle, silent, hopeless, and each for himself alone. But by the next day, they had already begun to shrink, to nestle against the earth with infinite weariness, as if trying to crawl into it. And if later they could be brought back, some were light and dried out, and the ones that were found weeks after were hardly more than skeletons that rattled loosely in uniforms suddenly far too big for them. It was a dry death, in sand, sun, and wind. In Russia, it was a greasy, stinking death. It had been raining for days. The snow was melting. A month earlier, it had been 3 yards deeper. The ruined village, which at first had seemed to be nothing but charred roofs, had silently, night by night, risen higher out of the sinking snow. Window frames had crept into sight. A few nights later, the archways of doors, then stairways that led down into the dirty whiteness. The snow melted and melted, and with the melting came the dead. They were old dead. The village had been fought over several times, in November, in December, in January, and now in April. It had been taken and lost and taken again. The snowstorms had come and covered the corpses, sometimes within hours, so deep that the medical corpsmen often could not find them, until finally almost every day had thrown a new layer of white over the devastation, like a nurse stretching a sheet over a bloody, filthy bed. First came the January dead. They lay highest and came out at the beginning of April, shortly after the snow began to slip. Their bodies were frozen stiff, and their faces were gray wax. They were buried like boards. On a little hill behind the village, where the snow was not so deep, it had been shoveled away and graves were hacked out of the frozen earth. It was heavy work. Only the Germans were buried. The Russians were thrown into an open paddock. They began to stink when the weather turned mild. When it got too bad, snow was shoveled over them. It was not necessary to bury them. No one expected that the village would be held for any length of time. The regiment was in retreat. The advancing Russians could bury their dead themselves. Beside the December dead were found the weapons that had belonged to the January dead. Rifles and hand grenades had sunk deeper than the bodies, sometimes steel helmets, too. It was easier with these corpses to cut away the identification marks inside the uniforms. The melting snow had already softened the cloth. Water stood in their open mouths as though they had drowned. In some cases, a limb or two had thawed out. When they were carried off, the bodies were still stiff, but an arm and a hand would dangle and sway as though the corpse were waving, hideously indifferent and almost obscene. With all of them, when they lay in the sun, the eyes thawed first. They lost their glassy brilliance and the pupils turned to jelly. The ice in them melted and ran slowly out of the eyes, as if they were weeping. Suddenly it froze again for several days. A crust formed on the snow and turned to ice. The snow stopped sinking, but then the sluggish, sultry wind began to blow anew. At first only a gray fleck appeared in the withering white. An hour later, it was a clenched hand stretching upward.
"There's another," Zowers said.
"Where?"
Immerman asked. "Over there in front of the church. Shall we dig him out?"
"What's the use? The wind will dig him out by itself. The snow back there is still a yard or two deep, at least. This damn village is lower than anything else around here. Or do you just want to get your boots full of ice water?"
"Hell no. Any idea what's to eat today?"
"Cabbage. Cabbage with pork and potatoes. Pork non-existent."
"Cabbage, of course. For the third time this week." Zaur unbuttoned his trousers and began to urinate. A year ago, I still pissed in great arcs, he explained morosely. In good military fashion, the way it's supposed to be done. I felt fine. Advance each day so and so many kilometers. Thought I'd soon be home again. Now I piss like a civilian, half-heartedly and without pleasure. Immerman stuck his hand under his uniform and scratched himself comfortably.
I wouldn't care how I pissed if I were a civilian again.
Me either, but it looks like we'd go on being soldiers forever.
Sure, heroes to the grave. Only the SS still piss in great arcs.
Zaur buttoned up his trousers. They can do it, too. We do the dirty work, and those beauties get all the honors. We fight for 2 or 3 weeks for some damn town, and on the last day, up come the SS and march into it triumphantly ahead of us. Just look at the way they're looked after. Always the thickest coats, the best boots, and the biggest chunks of meat. Immermann grinned.
Now even the SS aren't taking towns anymore. They're going back, just like us.
Not like us. We don't burn and shoot what we can't carry off with us. Immermann stopped scratching himself.
What's got into you today?
He asked in surprise.
You're talking like a human being. Take care Steinbrenner doesn't hear you or you'll soon find yourself in one of those disciplinary companies. Look, the snow over there is settled. Now you can see a piece of the fellow's arm.
Zaur looked over. If it goes on melting like this by tomorrow, he'll be hanging on a cross.
He's in the right place, right over the cemetery. Is that a cemetery there?
Of course, didn't you know? We were here once before, during our last counterattack, around the end of October. Weren't you with us then?
No.
Where were you? Hospital?
Disciplinary company.
Zaur whistled through his teeth. Disciplinary company? I'll be damned. For what?
Immermann looked at him. Former communist, he said.
What? And they let you out? How did it happen?
The fellow has to have luck. I'm a good mechanic. Apparently they are more useful now here than there.
Maybe, but as a communist, and here in Russia, they're always sent somewhere else.
Zaur suddenly looked at Immermann with suspicion.
Immermann grinned derisively.
Take it easy, he said. I haven't turned spy, and I won't report what you said about the SS. That's what you meant, wasn't it?
I? Not a bit of it. Never thought of such a thing.
Zaur reached for his mess kit.
There's the field kitchen. Quick, otherwise we'll only get dishwater.
The hand grew and grew. It was not as if the snow were melting, but as if the hand were slowly stretching up out of the earth, like a pale threat or a paralyzed gesture for help. The company commander halted abruptly.
What's that, over there?
Some panya or other, sir.
Raha looked more intently.
He could recognize a piece of the faded cloth on the sleeve.
That's no Russian, he said.
Sergeant Muka wriggled his toes in his boots. He could not bear the company commander. To be sure, he stood before him with irreproachable rigidity. Discipline transcended personal feelings. But privately, to express his contempt, he kept wriggling his toes in his boots. Stupid ass, he thought. Numbskull.
Get him out,
Raha said.
Yes, sir.
Get a couple of men to work at once. That sort of thing's not a pleasant sight.
Babe in arms, Muka thought. Twaddler. Not a pleasant sight, as though that was the first dead man we've seen.
That's a German soldier, Raha said.
Yes, sir. For the last 4 days we've found nothing but Russians.
Have them get him out. Then we'll see what he is.
Raha walked across to his quarters. Conceited ass, Muka thought. Has an oven, a warm house, and the Ritterkreuz. I haven't even the Iron Cross first class, and I've done just as much to earn it as he has with his whole hardware store.
Zaur, he shouted. Immermann, come here. Bring shovels along. Who else is there? Graeber, Hirschlund, Berning, Steinbrenner. Take charge of the detail. That hand over there, dig it out and bury it if it's a German.
I bet it isn't.
Steinbrenner sauntered over.
"You're betting?"
he asked. He had a high boyish voice, which he vainly tried to keep low.
"How much?"
Mooka was disconcerted for a moment. 3 rubles, he said then. 3 occupation rubles.
5. And don't bet less than 5.
All right, 5 then. But pay up. Steinbrenner laughed. His teeth glistened in the pale sunlight. He was 19 years old, blonde with the face of a gothic angel.
Pay up, of course. What else, Mooka?
Mooka did not like Steinbrenner either, but he was afraid of him and therefore cautious. Steinbrenner came from the SS. He possessed the golden insignia of the Hitler Youth. Now he belonged to the company, but everyone knew he was an informer and a Gestapo spy.
All right, Mooka pulled out of his pocket a cherrywood cigarette case that had a flower design burnt into its lid. Cigarette?
Sure.
The Fuhrer doesn't smoke, Steinbrenner, Immermann said casually.
Shut your trap.
Shut yours, you bastard.
Steinbrenner lifted his long eyelashes in a sidewise glance.
You seem to be feeling pretty good. Forgotten all sorts of things, haven't you?
Immermann laughed.
I don't easily forget anything, and I know just what you mean, Max. But don't you forget what it was I said. The Fuhrer doesn't smoke. That was all. Here are 4 witnesses, and the Fuhrer doesn't smoke. Everyone knows that.
Stop jawing, Mooka said.
Get on with the digging. Orders from the company commander.
All right, move.
Steinbrenner lighted the cigarette Mooka had given him.
Since when is smoking permitted on duty? Immermann asked.
We're not on duty, Mooka explained irritably. Now cut the talk and get going. Hirschlund, you too.
Hirschlund came up. Steinbrenner grinned.
First-rate work for you, Isaac. Digging out corpses. Good for your Jewish blood. Strengthens the bones and the spirit. Take that shovel over there.
I'm 3/4 Aryan,
Hirschlund said. Steinbrenner blew smoke from the cigarette into his face.
That's what you say. As far as I'm concerned, you're 1/4 Jew. And through the generosity of the Fuhrer, you're allowed to fight side by side with true German men. So dig out this Russian swine. He stinks too much for the lieutenant's delicate nose.
This is no Russian, Graber said. He had dragged a few boards up to the dead man and by himself begun to cut away the snow from around the arm and breast. The wet uniform was now clearly visible.
Not a Russian,
Steinbrenner came over, quick and sure-footed as a dancer on the teetering boards, and squatted down beside Graber.
It's a fact. That's a German uniform.
He turned around.
Mooka, it's not a Russian. I've won.
Mooka walked over heavily. He stared at the hole into which water was slowly trickling from the sides.
I can't understand it, he declared disgustedly.
For almost a week now, we've found nothing but Russians.
He must be one of the December lot that sank deeper. He might just as well be from October, Graber said. Our regiment came through here then.
Nonsense. There can't be any more of them left.
There could be. We fought a night engagement here. The Russians retreated and we had to go on at once.
That's true, Zauer announced. Nonsense. Our replacements must have found all the dead and buried them.
That's not so certain. By the end of October, it had started to snow very hard, and at that time we were still advancing fast.
That's the second time you've said that,
Steinbrenner looked at Graber. I'll be glad to let you hear it again if you like. At that time, we were counterattacking and we advanced more than 100 kilometers.
And now we're retreating, eh?
Now we're here again.
That means that we're in retreat, doesn't it?
Immermann nudged Graber warningly. Are we perhaps going forward? Graber asked.
We're shortening our lines,
Immermann said, staring derisively into Steinbrenner's face.
For a year now. Strategic necessity. Everyone knows that.
There's a ring on his hand,
Hirschlund said suddenly. He had gone on digging and had exposed the dead man's other hand. Mooka bent down.
A ring, he said. And a gold one, too. A wedding ring.
All of them looked at it.
Watch yourself, Immerman whispered to Graeber. That swine will do you out of your furlough. He'll report you as an alarmist. He's just waiting for the chance.
He's simply showing off. You're the one who'd better watch out. He's got it in for you more than for me.
I don't care. I won't get any furlough.
Those are the insignia of our regiment, Hirschlott said. He had gone on digging with his hands.
So, then it's dead certain that it's not a Russian, eh?
Steinbrenner turned and grinned at Mooka.
No, it's not a Russian, Mooka replied angrily.
5 rubles. Too bad we didn't bet 10. Cough it up.
I haven't got it on me.
Where then? In the Reichsbank? Come on, cough it up.
Mooka glared fiercely at Steinbrenner. Then he produced his wallet and handed over the money.
Everything's gone wrong today, damn it.
Steinbrenner pocketed the money. Graeber bent over again to help Hirschlott dig.
I believe it's Riker, he said.
What?
This is Lieutenant Riker. There are his bars, and here on his right hand, the last joint of the index finger is missing.
Nonsense. Riker was wounded and sent home. We heard that later.
It is Riker.
Clean off his face.
Graeber and Hirschlott went on digging.
Careful,
Mooka shouted.
Don't poke him in the head.
He won't feel it now, Immerman said.
Shut your trap. Here lies a fallen German officer, you communist.
The face emerged from the snow. It was wet and made a strange impression with the hollows of the eyes still filled with snow. As though a sculptor had left a mask unfinished and blind. A gold tooth gleamed between the blue lips.
I can't identify him, Mooka said.
It must be him. We didn't lose any other officer here that time.
Wipe out his eyes.
Graeber hesitated an instant. Then he cautiously wiped the snow away with his glove.
It's him, he said.
Mooka became excited. He took command himself. Since an officer was in question, a higher rank seemed necessary.
Lift him. Hirschlott and Zauer, take the legs. Steinbrenner and Berning, the arms. Graeber, take care of his head. Come on, all together. 1, 2, pull.
The body moved.
Once more. 1, 2, lift.
The body moved again. From under it, out of the snow, came a hollow sigh as the air rushed in.
Sergeant, the foot's come off,
Hirschlott shouted. It was the boot. It had come half off. The flesh of the foot had rotted in the melting snow and was giving way.
Let go! Let him down! Mooka shouted.
It was too late. The body jerked loose and Hirschlott held the boot in his hand.
Is the foot inside?
Immerman asked.
Put the boot down and go on shoveling,
Mooka shouted to Hirschlott.
How was anyone to know he was already so soft? And you, Immerman, shut up! Show some respect for the dead!
Immerman looked at Mooka in amazement, but he kept quiet. A few minutes later, they had finished shoveling the snow away from around the body. In the wet uniform, they found a wallet with papers. The handwriting had run, but was still legible. Graeber had been right. It was Lieutenant Riker, who had been a platoon leader in the company during the fall.
We must report this at once, Mooka said. Stay here. I'll be right back.
He went over to the house where the company commander lived. It was the only one that was still in some degree habitable. Before the revolution, it had probably belonged to the village priest. Raha was sitting in the big living room. Mooka stared spitefully at the broad Russian oven in which a fire was burning. On the oven bench, Raha's sheepdog was lying asleep. Mooka made his report, and Raha went out with him. He looked down for a while at Riker.
Shut his eyes,
he said then.
That can't be done, sir,
Graeber answered. The lids are too tender. They would tear. Raha looked over at the shell-torn church.
Take him over and put him in there for the time being. Have we a coffin?
The coffins were left behind, Mooka reported. We had a few for special occasions. The Russians have them now. I hope they'll have use for them.
Steinbrenner laughed. Raha did not laugh.
Can we make one?
It would take too long, sir,
Graeber said.
The body's very soft already. Besides, it's not likely there are any suitable boards in the town.
Raha nodded.
Lay him on a strip of canvas. We'll bury him in that. Hack out a grave and make a cross.
Graeber, Zauer, Immermann, and Berning carried the sagging body over to the church. Hirschland followed uncertainly with the boot, with a piece of foot still in it.
Sergeant Mucha,
Raha said.
Yes, sir.
Four captured guerrillas are being sent here today. They are to be shot early tomorrow morning. Our company has received orders to do it. Ask your section for volunteers. If you don't get them, the master sergeant will select names.
Yes, sir.
Heaven knows why it has to be us. Oh well, and all this confusion.
I volunteer,
Steinbrenner said.
Good.
Raha's face was expressionless. He stumped back over the pathway, shoveled in the snow. Back to his oven, Mucha thought. The dish clout. What does shooting a few gorillas amount to? As though they hadn't picked off hundreds of our comrades.
If the Russians come in time, they can dig the grave for Rika, too,
Steinbrenner said.
Then there won't be any work for us. Get it all done at once. What do you say, Mucha?
It's all right with me. Mucha's stomach was bitter. That schoolmaster, he thought. Thin, overgrown, a long lathe with horn-rimmed glasses. Lieutenant from the time of the First War, never promoted in this one. Brave, all right, who wasn't, but not a leader by nature.
What do you think of Raha?
He asked Steinbrenner. Steinbrenner looked at him uncomprehendingly.
He's our company commander, isn't he?
Certainly, but what else?
Else? What do you mean?
Nothing,
Mucha replied crossly.
Deep enough?
Asked the oldest Russian. He was a man of about 70 with a dirty white beard and very blue eyes, and he spoke broken German.
Shut up, Bolshevik. Speak only when you're spoken to,
Steinbrenner replied. He was in fine spirits. His eyes followed the woman who was one of the gorillas. She was young and strong.
Deeper,
Graeber said. He, together with Steinbrenner and Zauer, was supervising the prisoners.
For us?
The Russian asked. Steinbrenner sprang down quickly, lightly, and hit him hard in the face with the flat of his hand.
I told you, grandfather, to hold your tongue. What do you think this is, a country fair?
He smiled. There was no malice in his face. It was simply filled with the satisfaction of a child pulling the wings off a fly.
No, this grave is not for you, Graeber said.
The Russian did not move. He stood still and looked at Steinbrenner. Steinbrenner glanced back. His face suddenly changed. It became tense and watchful. He thought the Russian was going to attack him, and he was waiting for the first move. It would have made no difference to anyone if he had shot him then and there. The man had been condemned to death anyway, and no one would question very closely whether or not it had been a case of self-defense. But for Steinbrenner, it was not the same. Graeber could not tell whether it was a kind of sport for him to provoke the Russian so far that he would forget himself for a moment, or whether he still possessed a remnant of that strange pedantry which seeks through some subterfuge always to appear legal when committing murder. Both existed, and both at the same time. Graeber had seen it often enough. The Russian did not move. Blood ran out of his nose into his beard. Graeber considered for a moment what he would do in the same situation, whether he would throw himself on the other and risk instant death for the satisfaction of returning the blow, or accept anything in order to gain the few more hours, the one night of life. He did not know. The Russian bent slowly and lifted the pick. Steinbrenner took a step backward. He was ready to shoot, but the Russian did not straighten up again. He resumed his hacking at the bottom of the hole. Steinbrenner grinned.
Lie down there,
he said. The Russian put the pick aside and laid himself in the trench. He lay there quietly. A few pieces of snow fell on him as Steinbrenner stepped over the grave.
Is it long enough?
He asked Graeber.
Yes, Rika wasn't tall.
The Russian was looking upward. His eyes were wide open. The blue of the sky seemed to be reflected in them. The white hairs of the beard around his mouth stirred with his breath. Steinbrenner let him lie there for a while. Then he said, "Out!" The Russian climbed out. Wet earth clung to his coat. "So," Steinbrenner said, and glanced at the woman. "Now we'll go and dig your own graves. They don't need to be so deep. It makes no difference if the foxes eat you next summer." It was early morning. A pale red band lay along the horizon. The snow crackled. It had frozen again during the night. The open graves were very black.
"Damn it," Zauer said. "The things they load on us. Why do we have to do this? Why not the SD? After all, they're specialists in shooting people. Why us? This is the third time. We're supposed to be respectable soldiers."
Graeber held his rifle loosely in his hand. The steel was very cold. He put on his glove. "The SD keep busy farther back."
"Right. They don't come this near the front. Wasn't Steinbrenner with the SD earlier?"
"I think he was in a concentration camp, block warden or something like that." The others came up. Steinbrenner was the only one fully awake and rested. His skin had the rosy glow of a child.
"Listen," he said. "There's that cow in the bunch. Leave her for me."
"How do you mean for you?" asked Zauer. "There's not enough time for you to get her pregnant. You ought to have tried sooner."
"That's just what he did," Immerman said.
"Who told you that?" Steinbrenner asked. "The International?"
"And she wouldn't let him near her."
Steinbrenner turned around angrily.
"You're mighty sly, aren't you? If I had wanted to have the red cow, I'd have had her."
"Maybe not."
"Oh, cut the jawing." Zauer bit off a chew of tobacco. "If he means he wants to shoot her all by himself, he's welcome as far as I'm concerned. I won't fight him for that."
"Nor I,"
Graeber declared. The others said nothing. It grew lighter. Hirschlund looked at his watch.
"Aren't things going fast enough for you, Isaac?"
Steinbrenner asked.
"Be thankful you've been picked out for this. It's just the thing to cure your Jewish tearfulness." "Shooting," he spat. "Much too good for this gang. Ammunition wasted for that. They should be hanged, like everywhere else."
"Where?" Zauer looked around. "You see any trees? Or shall we build a gallows? And with what?"
"There they are," Graeber said. Muka appeared with the four Russians. Two soldiers marched in front of them and two behind. The old Russian came first. After him, the woman, and then the two younger men. The four arranged themselves without being told to, in a row in front of the graves. The woman glanced down before she turned around. She was wearing a red woolen skirt. Lieutenant Müller of the 1st Platoon came out of the company commander's house. He was Raha's representative at the execution. It was laughable, but formalities were still for the most part strictly carried out. Everyone knew that the four Russians might be guerrillas and then again, might not. They had been formally tried and condemned without ever having any real chance. What had there been to find out? They had been charged with possessing weapons. Now they were being shot with due formality and in the presence of an officer, as if it mattered to them one way or the other. Lieutenant Müller was 21 years old and had been assigned to the company 6 weeks before. He examined the condemned and then read the sentence.
"The cow's for me," Steinbrenner whispered.
Graeber looked at the woman. She stood calmly in her red skirt in front of the grave. She was strong and young and healthy and made to bear children. She did not understand what Müller was reading, but she knew it was her death sentence. She knew that in a few minutes the life that pulsed strong and healthy through her veins would cease forever. But she stood there calmly, as if it were nothing, and she were only a little chilly in the cold morning air. Graeber saw that Muka was officiously whispering to Müller. Müller glanced up.
"Can't that be done afterward?"
"It's better this way, sir. Simpler."
"All right. Arrange it as you like." Luca stepped forward. "Tell that one over there to take off his shoes," he said to the old Russian, who understood German, and pointed at one of the younger prisoners. The old man told the other. He spoke in a low, almost sing-song tone. The other man, a gangling fellow, at first did not understand.
"Come on," Luca growled. "Shoes! Take off your shoes!"
The old man repeated what he had said before. The younger one understood and, like someone who had neglected his duty, hastened to take off his shoes as quickly as possible. He wobbled, standing on one foot while he drew the shoe off the other. Why is he rushing so? Graeber thought. So that he can die a minute sooner? The man took his shoes in one hand and offered them obsequiously to Muka. They were good shoes. Muka snorted in order and pointed to one side. The man placed the shoes there and then stepped back into line. He stood in dirty foot bandages on the snow. His yellow toes protruded from the wrappings, and he kept curling them in embarrassment. Muka inspected the others. He found that the woman had a pair of thick fur gloves and ordered her to lay them beside the shoes. The red skirt held his attention for a moment. It was untorn and of good material. Steinbrenner grinned surreptitiously, but Muka did not tell the woman to take it off. Either he was afraid that Raha might be watching the execution from his window, or he did not know what could be done with the skirt. He stepped back. The woman said something very rapidly in Russian. "Ask her what more she wants," Lieutenant Mueller said. He was pale. This was his first execution. Muka questioned the old Russian.
"She doesn't want anything. She is just cursing you."
"What?" shouted Mueller, who had not understood any of it.
"She is cursing you," the Russian said louder. "She is cursing you and all Germans who stand on Russian soil. She is cursing your children. She hopes that her children will someday shoot down your children, just as you are now shooting her down." "What impertinence!" Muka was staring at the woman. "She has two children," said the old man, "and I have three sons."
"That's enough, Muka," Mueller shouted nervously. "We're not chaplains. Attention!" The group of soldiers came to attention. Graeber took hold of his rifle. He had taken off his glove again. The cold steel seemed to suck at his thumb and index finger. Beside him stood Hirschland. He was yellow, but he stood firm. Graeber decided to aim at the Russian farthest to the left. In the beginning, when he had been commanded to take part in executions, he had shot into the air, but that was past. Doing it was no favor to those who were to be shot. Others had had the same idea, and there had been times when almost everyone had intentionally missed the mark. The shooting had to be repeated, and so the prisoners were executed twice. Once, to be sure, a woman had thrown herself on her knees after not being hit, and had thanked them with tears for the minute or two of life she had gained. He didn't like to think about that woman. Anyhow, that sort of thing did not happen anymore.
"Take aim!"
Over his sight, Graeber saw the old Russian with the beard and blue eyes. The gun sight cut his face in two. Graeber lowered it. The last time he had shot away someone's lower jaw. The breast was safer. He saw that the barrel of Hirschland's rifle was raised and that he intended to shoot over their heads.
"Muka's watching you. Aim lower. Sidewise," he murmured.
Hirschland lowered the barrel.
"Fire!"
came the command. The Russian seemed to rise and come toward Graeber. He swelled out like a man seen in a convex mirror in some funhouse at a country fair. He swelled out and then fell backward. The old man had been hurled half in and half out of the grave. His feet protruded from it. The two other men had sunk down where they stood. The other one, without shoes, had thrown up his hands in the last minute to protect his face. One hand hung like a rag from the tendons. None of the Russians had had their hands tied or their eyes bandaged. It had been forgotten. The woman had fallen forward. She was not dead. She had propped herself on her hands and was staring with lifted face at the group of soldiers. Steinbrenner wore a satisfied expression. No one else had aimed at her. She had been shot in the stomach. Steinbrenner was a good marksman. The old Russian struck at something from the grave. Then he was still. Only the woman still lay propped up there. She stared out of her broad face at the soldiers and hissed. The old Russian was dead, and now no one could translate what she was saying. She lay there with her arms braced like a great bright frog that could go no farther, and she hissed without turning her eyes aside for an instant. She seemed hardly to notice as Mooka approached disgustedly from the side. She hissed and hissed, and only at the last moment did she see the revolver. She thrust her head to one side and bit Mooka in the hand. Mooka cursed and, with a downward blow of his left hand, knocked her lower jaw loose. As the teeth let go, he shot her in the nape of the neck.
"Damned bad marksmanship,"
Mooka growled.
"Don't you know how to aim?"
"It was Hirschland, sir,"
Steinbrenner reported.
"It was not Hirschland," Graber said.
"Quiet,"
Mooka shouted.
"Wait till you're asked."
He glanced over at Mueller. Mueller was very pale and stood without moving. Mooka bent over the other Russians. He put his revolver behind the ear of one of the younger men and fired. The head jerked and lay still. Mooka put his revolver back and looked at his hand. He took out a handkerchief and wrapped it.
"Have some iodine put on it,"
Mueller said.
"Where's the infirmary?"
"In the third house on the right, sir."
"Go there at once."
Mooka went. Mueller looked across at the dead. The woman lay sunk over forward on the wet ground.
"Put them in and cover them up,"
he said. He was suddenly very angry, without knowing why.